fun. I had to speak with each of them again at length. So first up will be Allison Burnett. Allison is the author of the acclaimed novel Christopher, which was a finalist for Penn Center USA's Literary Award in Fiction. He lives in Los Angeles, where he is also a studio screenwriter. And we are going to talk about his most recent book today, The House Beautiful, published by Carolyn Graff, as well as a bunch of other things. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Barbara. Pleasure to be here, sort of.
Great to have you.
It's definitely a pleasure. I'm just sort of here in the sense that we're so far away from each other, but it's the miracle of modern technology.
It is.
Have your listeners finished reeling from the fact that I'm a guy? they hear Allison.
Well, you know, there's a few things to reel from. And the other is that House Beautiful... B.K. Troop, the main character, is a middle-aged, witty, bipolar, alcoholic, homosexual living in a New York apartment. And you seem to be very much the opposite, as well as living on the opposite side of the country.
Yes, well, you know, I lived in New York for 10 years, and I stored up a lot of experience. And then when I moved to Los Angeles in 1990, I began to write movies. And after close to a decade of doing that, I really missed writing fiction, and I really missed having the authorial control that one does not get writing films. And so I went back to my roots, and I began writing about that decade of the 80s during which I lived in Manhattan. And I've now written three novels about that period. Two are in stores, and one will be coming out at some point in the future. And yes, my narrator is tall, fat, bald, middle-aged, alcoholic. He's very poor hygiene. He's chemically imbalanced, and he's gay. And I'm none of those. And so that caused a lot of consternation, I think, among critics and people. But most of them thought it was kind of a wonderful thing that I wasn't afraid to have my narrator be gay.
Now, how did you come up with him?
You know, I can't. It wasn't anything literal. I mean, I had a story I wanted to tell about life in 1984, life about this one young artist and a writer who had just come out of a divorce, and he's only 25 years old, and he's dealing with all of these issues about his failed idealism and where his future is going. And I wanted it to be narrated by someone that was outside the action, someone that had a great deal invested in what happened to Christopher, but was not actually participating in many of the events. And I just gravitated toward the fact that, well, it'd be nice if it was someone that was invested because he was in love with him, or at least obsessed with him. And then, sure, I suppose it could have been a woman, but, you know, it's quite an old archetype of New York life that young, you know, young artists are often... they find mentors in older gay men. It's very much at the center of life in the New York art world. And that certainly happened to me with professors in college and in life in New York. And so BK just sort of spontaneously was born, and I wanted a character where I could put no limits on my humor, on my literary illusions. BK has read all of Western literature, every romantic poem, Victorian poetry. He collects photographs of authors. He's completely steeped in Western literature, and I wanted to be able to use those illusions and use that humor and not have to in any way patronize the reader, really just let him be as smart as I as a writer can be and he can be. And it was really liberating. Was when you work in Hollywood, you're constantly worried about making somebody sort of too smart, making it too elitist, not reaching a large audience. And in fiction, you know, you don't have that pressure. So I really, really enjoyed writing him, and I loved him so much that I wrote another novel and then another novel, and they all narrated by B.K. Troop. And I'm happy to announce that I'm trying to put together a movie of Christopher for me to direct, and I've written the screenplay, and John Lithgow just attached himself to play B.K. Troop. So
that is very cool.
So that should make putting the movie together fairly straightforward in terms of other casts, because he's such a great actor, people want to work with him, and I think it'll be a really great role for him.
Yeah, that's great. Well, before we go on, it'd be great to give our listeners a taste of B.K. Troop and The House Beautiful. Could you read a little bit?
Sure. this is, you know, the house beautiful is BK, one of his friends dies and leaves him a brownstone in New York City. And he realizes very quickly, after crunching some numbers, that he can't afford the rent and the tax. He can't afford the taxes and the upkeep. So the only way he can keep the brownstone is he has to rent out rooms. So he decides to rent out rooms only to artists. And if he had his way, they'd probably be some gay artists. But young gay men don't want to spend too much time around BK because he's so aggressive. So it's all everyone that moves into the house is straight, except for one gorgeous lesbian that can't stand BK. Anyway, so this is his BK's first description of one of the tenants, whose name is Carl Allen Dealey. And when we find him, he's sort of lazing out the window, smoking a cigarette, looking into his backyard, and this is how BK describes him.
Okay.
Carl, 30 now, losing daily both muscle tone and hair, dreaded another summer in the city. Baking garbage, human stink, subways like speeding coffins, midnight sirens, damp, dirty morning sheets wrung tight as tourniquets. Worst of all was the telephone. It slept at his side now. The only person who knew its secret number was his talent agent. The last time it had jangled, a month before, it had brought him news of an audition for a honey commercial in which, had he not overslept, he might very well have been cast as a bumblebee. Sadly, this ebony abomination was the center of his existence. There was not a moment when his conscious or unconscious mind was not on bended knee, praying that it would ring. During the year, it rarely did. During the summer, it never did. How on earth would he distract himself until fall? His answer came when his eyes landed on a window across the way. It was wide open and bore no blind. For a long time now, the flat inside had been empty, but now he spied a television, a hanging plant, a Renoir print, a frilly lamp, and a fancy antique vanity. His reverie was abruptly struck by the sound of footsteps outside his door. Who could it be? Was it some new lodger? The door opened, and before Carl could yell, "Go away," the face of a young woman appeared. She was tiny, with owlish blue eyes and blonde hair yanked into pigtails. Her long johns were pollocked with paint. "You're up," she said, her voice shy and soft. "Ever heard of knocking?" Carl snapped. "Can't you see I'm busy?" Immune to sarcasm, Miranda Buchner scanned the filthy disarray of Carl's room to see what he was busy with. Nothing suggested itself. Maybe it was his acting. Maybe that's how actors did it. They memorized all those lines while looking out the window. "An audition?" she asked hopefully. "Yeah, I'm working on a monologue for the unemployment people. What the hell do you want?" And that's our little introduction to Carl and Miranda.
That's great.
In the course of the story, we meet all seven artists, and we follow their adventures and their loves and their art and all the things they're struggling with. And meanwhile, we're also following all of BK's adventures. And they cross a lot because BK snoops on them. He goes through their papers. He rifles through their rooms. He's completely obsessed with the lives of others, which allows me great latitude as a novelist because BK is at once very subjective, and he also narrates as though he's omniscient.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, and before we go on, let me just say that you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Allison Burnett, author of The House Beautiful, which he just read from. I wanted to ask you about that exact thing, because I'm reading along. The book, I believe, begins in close first person.
Very close,
and,
yes.
And then we somehow very capably drift into other points of view, or just we're witnessing other characters as if BK is no longer there.
And then suddenly he is.
And then he's there again, yeah.
Yes, and what happens is that BK believes, he tells his story in the virtually omniscient first-person narrator, which he believes is really startling and brand new and brave. He believes that he is so insightful and knows people so well that he can actually narrate their inner lives. But what you slowly discover is that it's a little more complicated than that, because he reads because Christopher and one of the women in The House Beautiful are both writing novels, he actually steals their manuscripts and he plagiarizes at will. So really what you slowly discover is that you're reading an amalgam of BK's perceptions and asides and things that he's witnessed merged with a failed novel written by someone who lives in the house, or in Christopher's case, written by Christopher about his own life.
Yes.
And he lets you know that he's stealing from the manuscript. He just doesn't let you know for a very long time. So in a strange way, it's a merging of the literary, the lover of literature. BK loves literature, but is not really creative. So he's a parasite on the world of creative people. And he constantly tells you that he can only write things that he's personally beheld. He can't invent anything. But that doesn't mean he's telling the truth, because he's so delusional that he probably invents a lot more than he realizes. So anyway, it's a complicated point of view, and I think it makes for a great deal of fun. I think if people get too rigid and strict and literal about it, it might frustrate them that he can move in and out of other people's lives.
I like it. I like it. I kept finding myself wondering how you came to the point of view. I mean, were you just experimenting, or did it just naturally kind of happen?
You know, I really wanted it to be a blending of the omniscient and the subjective. I knew that was kind of fresh, and I thought that BK was so... See, originally when I thought of the story for Christopher, I thought, well, it's 1984, so who's Big Brother? Who's watching? We know the state wasn't watching in 1984. They didn't start watching us till about 2003. Who is watching Christopher? And I said, well, if there's an obsessive neighbor who's in love with him, he could be watching, and what if he's so obsessive that he actually believes that he can narrate Christopher's inner life? And I went from there.
Interesting.
And in the third book, he's an old man, and he's in Los Angeles, and he's a little bit, he does a lot less of that. He's living more and observing less. That's part of his evolution. BK is constantly growing. He starts off just an absolutely appalling curmudgeon, and as time goes, he becomes humanized in the books.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So as he enters the sphere of the living, as actually having a life and not just dreaming in his room, he actually starts to become less omniscient and more subjective.
Mm. You know, I wanted to ask you about... again, back to BK and how you came up with him. And today I was exploring your website and following links, and I found, and his website, by the way, all of you out there, is allisonburnett.com.
Yeah, I thought of that myself. Do you like
it? You thought of that yourself?
It's pretty brilliant, isn't it?
Very creative. You could just Google his name even and find it. I think it's at the top of the page.
It is.
Anyway, and I followed it to an interview. It might have been on Media Bistro.
Yeah.
Where you were talking about having to come out as a heterosexual writer.
Yes, it was. I've published this story in many locations because when I wrote the second book, I kind of rewrote it because a lot had changed since then. But essentially what happened was my agent told me I had sold Christopher. I was over the moon. I mean, even though, you know, I have a career as a screenwriter, and this makes, you know, novels make no money, it was a much bigger thrill than getting movies made. And I was thrilled. And she said, but now in the next breath, she said, but look, listen, the editor thinks he's discovered a new gay writer, so it might be a good idea if you just, you know, don't tell, and they probably won't ask. And, you know, because we want him to publish your next novel, and we don't want to sort of unqueer the deal. And so I said, oh, well, I really, you know, I'm a very honest person. At the same time, I thought, you know, my sexuality is really not relevant. Like, why should it be relevant to the enjoyment of this book? So it worked out great because my editor was in New York and I'm in L.A., and he's gay, and we would have long conversations about things. And he was stunned that I'd never watched The Golden Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, hey, what did you think of Fag Hag? And I'd say, what's that? And he goes, you've never heard of it? It's this novel. And he couldn't believe I hadn't read this popular novel that I'd never even heard of. And so this went on this way, and then finally we had a conversation where, you know, I told him about some famous actor I met, and he said, oh, is he one of us? And I knew that if I remained silent, I'd be lying, so I explained, and he was great about it. And from that point on, I just was very selective about how and when I talked about it, but I just discovered that these websites just didn't care. I mean, they published me on a gay, bi, lesbian, transgender website. They published a short story of mine, and I was the first straight person they ever published, and they were happy to do it. And I discovered that most of the gay literary people that interviewed me were tickled and flattered that I was not uptight and that I was willing to write in the gay narrator's voice. Because on the one hand, it has my books have a built-in audience. Because gay readers are very open to it. But on the other hand, you know, they're really not what would you would call gay fiction. So my book has been rather ghettoized in that sense. And even like Barnes & Noble, they call it a gay novel. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, you know, like in House Beautiful, there are, you know, seven straight people and two gay people. It doesn't make sense. My friend said, is Oliver Twist orphan fiction? I mean, that's how I feel, but I'm still very grateful. I'm very grateful for the built-in audience, and I just hope that over time it bleeds into the straight community.
That's just such a great story, and that was a wonderful piece. You know,
because
I don't think I even knew how this all came about and what sort of, you know.
I was very naive. Like, it never occurred to me how much backlash there'd be. And ironically, it was like my straight, liberal, you know, open-minded friends that would take me aside and go, what are you doing, man? Like, you know, no one's going to read these books. I mean, what's wrong with you? You can't write a gay narrative. This is crazy. Like, women just love BK Troop, and gay men and women seem to. And it was only, like, certain straight friends that were very, very uptight about it.
I like him very much, and I just really enjoyed the book and enjoy the writing. And the writing, it's interesting because it, you know, meeting you and then reading the character, I thought, this is really interesting because it's not, I mean, he's just a really different type of character with a very interesting syntax, very interesting sort of almost formal way he speaks.
Yeah, I really see him as the sort of last gasp of old world Western culture. Like, to me, he's a conglomeration of all of the great tradition of English novelists and English poets. That's the world he loves. He's from Fargo, North Dakota. You know, he's just an American, but he speaks a bit like an Englishman, and he has a lot of the pomposity of the Queen Mum, practically. You know, he's really different, and I love him, and I channel. I don't really think about it. I don't really question anything. I just let it flow. And as you know, Raymond Chandler has some great line about, you know, when you have a character who gets up and starts walking and talking, you don't question it. You just write as fast as you can, you know. Yeah. And that's what I do.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. And I am talking with Allison Burnett, who is author of The House Beautiful, published by Carolyn Groff. The other thing you do, well, many other things, you write in other genres. You're a poet, a journalist, a screenwriter. Talk about this.
Well, you know, after I could easily have just kept my head down and just continued to do screenwriting forever. I make a great living. I enjoy it. It's fun. But I realized I wrote a script called Autumn in New York that was made into a movie with Richard Gere and Winona Ryder.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 days before shooting this $35 million movie, Richard Gere snapped his fingers and they hired someone to rewrite. 3 days before on a script I'd worked on for 2 years. And the script was really, really damaged terribly. And I realized that if I could write a script that was that celebrated, that made me that much, gave me that much acclaim around Hollywood, and then have it turned into a movie that by many people's estimation is not good, that I was never going to be safe. So I sort of cast my eyes backward to my whole life before I ever stepped foot in L.A., which was all about literature and writing poetry and short stories and fiction and plays, but I just never had an agent. I never had any way to connect and sell anything. I just was very alone in New York City. So now that I had an agent for my screenwriting, they were the agents that sold my novel. And then when the novel got published, suddenly places were wanted the short stories. The same short stories that I couldn't sell when I was nobody in New York were now really getting me a lot of attention. And then I found that websites were wanting to publish my poetry. So I've just really been enjoying this second life in a more literary sphere. And, you know, it's incredibly rewarding. And it means that the money I'm making in Hollywood goes to a good cause, which is that it allows me to take a year off and write a book. Mm-hmm. I can put the money to some use other than trying to get a bigger house or a bigger car, which is the trap that most screenwriters fall into. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but the irony of this is that when I really let go of all of that and put my focus on literature, I stumbled into an incredible relationship with the chairman of a film company here who has made two of my movies in the last 9 months, and they're both they're coming out soon. And then a movie I wrote 10 years ago came back out of nowhere, and that got made. And so I've had three movies coming out between now and January. After spending, 15 years here and only having a few little independent movies made in autumn in New York, suddenly I have three big movies coming out in the next year. So it's just been really fun. And the best part is they're not changing my scripts. They're actually, they've actually sort of learned, I don't know, it's the same people that made Autumn in New York, and they just don't let directors and actors change scripts anymore.
Hmm. So talk about just, the different sorts of things, the different process that you go through in writing scripts as with novels.
I still wake up at dawn. I still work till lunchtime. I'm in the same room. I do the same thing. The main difference is that when I'm writing outside of the world of screenplays, the sky's the limit. I'm not. There's no jury in my head. There's no judge that is telling me what I can and cannot do because it will offend so and so. When you're writing a blueprint for a $30 million movie, you're constantly, there's so many things you have to be aware of, and you can't push the envelope too far. And with writing fiction, it's just me and my muse. I can do whatever I want, and it's a great feeling of freedom. A lot of my screenwriting is also adaptations of things.
Mm-hmm.
Either I'm rewriting a previous script that someone else wrote, usually starting over almost from scratch, or I'm adapting a novel. I'm doing a lot of that lately. And so then I have the book to think about and the fans of the book and a lot of other considerations.
Mm-hmm. So adapting a novel, what happens? I mean, in a nutshell,
I'll give you an example. I adapted a beloved novel called The Feast of Love. And it was a finalist for the National Book Award. It was written by Charles Baxter, who's mm-hmm. a pretty widely loved novelist.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful book. And people had tried to adapt it before, and it was very hard to adapt, depending on the decisions you made. So I needed to look at this book, and I needed to forget. First of all, I can't be worried too much about the fans of the book. I have to think about the people sitting in that movie theater, because more people will see this movie probably than ever read the book. Just mm-hmm. the demographics of film are such that it's true. And I have to, put my focus on them as much as I can while trying to use every word from the book I can. I want to do that, but I can't be a slave to it. So I look at it and I make just dramaturgical decisions. Like, there are two sort of lordly figures in the book who have big points of view, and I can't have two of them in a movie. It doesn't work that way. And since one of them in the book was sort of a novelist figure, I didn't want to have a novelist at the core of a movie, because mm-hmm. movies don't work well in that kind of literary mode. So I sort of blended their characteristics, and I created this character, sort of a blend of them. And it's played by Morgan Freeman in the movie, mm-hmm. which opens in September. And then I find the structure, and I usually have to go in and say to the head of the company, this is what I want to do to the book, this is how I want to shape it, these are the things I want to do, and I get approval, and I go and do it. And then we do draft after draft and just get it, as beautiful as we can get it, and that's it. It's just a blending of respect for the book, but with a much bigger loyalty to the movie-going experience.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people cling to the book and write, either dull movies or movies that are just plain bad that just don't work. And I think it's really important not to be a slave.
And it sounds like you're rather detached too from the resulting movie as opposed to a novel, which is all yours.
Yeah, I mean, once you're done with the screenplay, you just hope and pray the director does a good job and the actors do a good job, and it's so out of your own, it's really out of your hands. You're not invited to the set usually. They don't really need you around if you've done your job. And so you put yourself in the hands of the good Lord and you just let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to say that the two movies I have opening this summer, one's based on an LA Times Sunday Magazine article about a homeless man that was living in Orange County in Santa Ana, and he was sweeping the streets, and a journalist got wind that he was actually a heavyweight contender, a boxer that was now old and had become homeless. And it's a true story. It's called Resurrecting the Champ. I wrote it 10 years ago, and then it was rewritten, and then a great director came along and merged the two drafts. So I get co-credit for the story and the screenplay. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the movie, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's Sam Jackson and Josh Hartnett. And, you know, you're just exhilarated. It's almost like giving birth to a baby, and you know it's a healthy baby, and it's beautiful, and then you don't see it again until it's graduating high school. And you go, wow, it looks like I imagined. It got straight A's, and it's beautiful. You know, it's healthy. That's what you pray for. And then Autumn in New York is like turning over your beautiful baby, and the next thing you know, it comes home from kindergarten, and it's got an arm sticking out of its head, and you barely recognize this creature, what's been done to it.
So we should all run out and see Autumn in New York before Feast of Love.
Yeah, that's an object lesson in how they're good. Because, I mean, Resurrecting the Champ is a really good movie. And I would, if it weren't good, I wouldn't even talk about it. I would just, because I don't like the bullet, you know, I would just sort of not even bring it up. It's a wonderful movie, and it premiered at Sundance, and it did great. And then The Feast of Love is absolutely beautiful. Morgan Freeman and Greg Kinnear and Rhoda Mitchell. It's just an absolutely beautiful movie.
I can't wait to see both of them. We're sort of at the end of our time, but I wanted to know a little bit more, just a minute's worth of process again. When I saw you at the LA Times Book Festival, I recall you saying, and it was really early in the morning, and you said, "I've already done my writing for the day."
Yeah.
Do you get up at the crack of dawn and get your writing
done?
Yeah,
I've been doing that for years and years. Now that I have a 15-month-old baby, it's even easier because our sleep is sort of turned on its head. But I wake up, I'm usually at my desk between... probably sometimes it's earlier, but between 6 and 7 usually, and I work until lunchtime. The day of the festival, I had been up at 5, so I did like 4 hard hours of work, and I got a ton done. Mm-hmm. And with this schedule, since it's day in, if I had my way, I'd do it on Saturdays and Sundays too. And we're going on vacation in 10 days, and I'm going to do it on vacation because it's so early, there's nothing else to do. You know what I mean? It's so early in the morning. What am I going to do at 6 in the morning? So I get all my work done, and you get a lot done, boy, if you work 7 days a week for 6 hours. It's amazing what you can accomplish, and it becomes addictive. It's like going to the gym. You know, if you go every day, you can't imagine not going. But if you don't write, it's as addictive as not going to the gym. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So you've got to work that muscle and create a system for yourself, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I so have enjoyed talking to you. And when your next book comes out, please come back on. I would love to talk more.
I would love to. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Okay, take care.
That was Alison Burnett, author of The House Beautiful, published by Carol and Graff. Again, his website is alisonburnett.com. Alison has 2 L's. Burnett has 2 T's. Do check it out. A lot going on there, and what a wonderful writer. Very happy to talk with him. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we should be here with Meryl Marco, so please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. You know, little darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The Claire Trevor School of the Arts has many dance, drama, music, and studio arts performances throughout the school year on the campus of UC Irvine. Events range from student ensembles to masterclasses given by professionals throughout the year that are open to the public. For more information on events and ticket prices, visit www.arts.uci.edu.
Hi, doctor. Do you have the results of my eye exam?
Yes. I'm sorry to say that you have macular degeneration.
What's that?
Macular degeneration causes loss of central vision and is the leading cause of blindness in those over 55. While there's no cure, there's hope, thanks to research funded by the Foundation Fighting Blindness. For free information, call 800-632-2005. That's 800-632-2005.
This public service announcement was brought to you by an educational grant from GlaxoSmithKline.
You know, folks, I've written so many songs, it's kind of hard to keep track of all of them. But here's one the folks seem to like, and I like it too. Here's the way it goes.
Join me, Wanda, for Howdylicious, the best in Western swing, rockabilly, classic country, and alternative twangy music, every Sunday night from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., only on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm still in a parking lot in Orange County, and I do have my next guest on the line, Meryl Marco. I'm so happy to talk to her again. She's the author of a number of books, including the most recent Walking in Circles Before Lying Down. She was a head writer of the David Letterman Show. She has so much going on. She has a website, too, which I believe is MerylMarco.com, and we'll ask her about that when we have her on. She has lots of fans, and they all want to hear from her, so let's bring her on. Hi, Meryl.
Hi.
Great to talk to you again. I had so much fun with you at the L.A. Times Book Festival that I just wanted to talk to you at length and have some time to go a little bit more into this book and into your writing. Walking in Circles Before Lying Down. I love the title, and
thank you.
I love the book. Will you talk about how the book came about?
Well, I live pretty much in a herd of dogs, and I talk to them continuously, and I And I always think that they are funny. I mean, life seems much funnier to me with dogs than without. And I have a long history of kind of trying to imagine their responses to common things. I have a very particular way I like to write them, which is I like to stay inside of the framework of what I think they could possibly be thinking about, which is a very minimal amount of topics. And then I try to imagine that they're very articulate on those topics for really no reason other than my own amusement. And so I wanted to write a book that where I fleshed out my feelings for dogs and all my thoughts about them and put it all in one place. I've written a lot of short pieces like that before that people have liked, and I thought I would try to write a long one.
Interesting. Well, I loved it too, and as I was reading it, I haven't had a dog in a long time. I have cats, but I remember saying to my son, we've got to go to the pound. And he said, why? I said, we need a dog again. It's time for a dog again.
Well, a pound
is a place to go. So I started asking
my
cats what they thought. And they didn't really answer me. So I do like so much how your main character in this book has conversations, as you said, with dogs and with her one particular dog. And then after this book I read, It's My Effing Birthday, and your character in that book has conversations with herself. And so I found that really interesting that in the book before this, your character's having conversations with herself, and then in this book, your character is having conversations with dogs.
Oh, she got sick of herself. She got over herself in this book. She moved on to her imaginary self.
She moved on. Yeah, but I just love it. And I remember on the panel at the Festival of Books, you were talking about, because, of course, since then, now I'm reading everything into everything, but remember you talking about how you found your mother's journals and you expected to be enlightened or have an epiphany or something, and it was just the opposite. And I found that journal, the journal thing, in It's My Effing Birthday.
Yeah, I wrote it into there.
Yeah, so do you do that a lot? I mean, are you able to take a lot from life and just translate it into fiction and have it work?
Well, to me, using the things that you see in life and find interesting in some creative way is one of the really fun things about being alive. And perhaps the really special thing about trying to be an artist, really, is to reinterpret stuff, especially upsetting stuff, in some way. It's kind of if life hands you lemons, make lemonade. Kind of, you know, I mean, it gives you a way to own and recast things that you find unnerving, upsetting, etc., especially if you make them funny. You know, you've then sort of conquered them in a kind of a miniature way.
Mm-hmm.
I always do that. I always try to keep notes whenever my attention is gotten by something I find either very upsetting or very funny. I always keep notes about it so that I can try to remember to put it in something.
Yes. Does your humor go onto the page seamlessly, or is there a lot of crafting?
You just
are naturally a funny person, so I'm wondering if it must just be easier for you than writers who may not be so naturally funny.
Well, there's nothing very easy about it in general for me. I mean, it's easier for me to write short pieces than it is for me to write a novel. For me, writing novels has been a really arduously tedious and terrifying and lengthy process. It just isn't easy. I mean, to keep a thing going for 300 pages and have it make coherent sense, like it flows from one thing to the next, it's just unspeakably hard to me. It's really a difficult thing to do. It always reminds me of that, back when I was a kid, there used to be the Ed Sullivan Show. You probably remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to have that plate spinning guy.
Yeah.
A circus act, a guy who would spin like 12 plates at the same time, and he'd run down to the end of the line, and he'd start the first plate spinning again after he got the eighth plate spinning, and then he just keep running around spinning those plates, and that's what it feels like writing a novel to me. Like, oh my God, the first plate is not going to be spinning anymore. Oh, God.
Oh, well,
I find it really hard. I think it's very difficult because you can't see it. I mean, if you were making a movie, you could at least look at it and watch it and see if it made coherent sense. You have to go back and read it, you know, and when you're in the middle of it, you think, what did I say at the beginning? There's so much of it. It's very hard.
Do you do any sort of plotting or outlining?
I do all kinds of plotting and outlining, and yeah, I completely do that. I have just a whole. I always have an outline, and then I try to make it not a written in stone kind of an outline. I try to give myself in the writing a chance to go anywhere with it, and a lot of times the outline is not the way that the book ends up, but. I always at least have to feel I know a beginning, a middle, and an end. I've tried that thing. I keep reading about other people who just turn on the faucet and the thing flows out and they don't know what it's going to be until they write it and stuff. And I could never do that because I'm just too at ease with words. If I go turn on the tap and just see whatever comes out, I can just BS myself indefinitely and just keep spinning around and go, oh, hey, got 8 pages today, and then I didn't say a damn thing. I mean, I have to know I'm going somewhere and be driving toward it, or I'm not. I'm just be kidding myself.
Yeah, that's interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Meryl Marco, author of Walking in Circles Before Lying Down, and a number of other books. Well, I wanted to ask you, well, that's in relation also to my next question, which is I just wondered about your character, Dawn, in Walking in Circles Before Lying Down. Her name is later used in a Tony Orlando song. A Tony Orlando song that Dawn comes up. And so I started thinking, I wonder if she chose this name so she could use Tony Orlando toward the end of the book.
No, I chose the name as an homage to the woman who walks my dogs.
Okay.
I have a dog walker named Dawn.
And then Tony Orlando, the song just kind of came.
No, and I was just ruminating on it. That later it was, you know, it was one of those things that later became something I could use in the plot, but
yes.
It was a complete homage to her.
It was great. Okay.
In fact, it was a physical description of her, too.
Oh, okay.
She never did any of those things that I wrote about, but I kind of imagined her into it. I asked her if I had permission to use her as a thought for a character, and she was happy with it.
I bet she was. What about the characters in both of these books, Walking in Circles Before Lying Down and It's My Effing Birthday, both, I believe, are 36 when the novels open. And I was curious about that. I mean, you do a different thing with age and It's My Effing Birthday. But what is it about 36?
Well, I guess what I was more interested in is that it seems like there are a lot of ages anymore that don't really signify anything. I mean, everyone's 20 is the new 30, and 30 is the new 20, and whatever all this stuff is. They keep saying 16 is the new 51 or whatever it is. But lots of ages all seem to be the new, you know, 24 to me. Like, they're everything. Everybody's nowhere, you know. Like, but when you hit 40, it's any more the one age that seems to mean something. I don't, maybe it's all changed again and it's only hitting 50 that means anything anymore. But for me, 30 really never really, you know, people used to say when I was coming up, oh, 30, oh, that was a big one. But it didn't really hit me at all, but 40 did. And so I sort of saw 40 as a demarcation line where, you know, it hits the fan kind of, you know, like, it's no longer just a life of potential. If you're not sort of fulfilling things and you're not really kind of driving toward what you mean to be doing, then you better take a look at that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have all the time in the world to just start. And and so I guess that's why I kind of like things around that cusp. You're still youthfully stupid if you want to be, but but you ought to know better.
Oh, that's funny. What about the structure? Now, It's My Effing Birthday. I want to talk about the structure of this book for a minute because I found it really fun that every chapter is a year. It's her next birthday. It starts when she turns 36, and it goes on until she's 40-something. How'd you come up with the structure?
You know, that was the first novel I ever wrote, and I was so intimidated by the idea of writing a novel. I always wrote short essays, funny pieces. And I was so intimidated by it that I really couldn't begin to figure out how to write a novel. And then, weirdly enough, I had a conversation with Moon Zappa, and who was not known for her literary advice particularly, but who said to me she had just written a novel. And I said, how in the world did you know how to write a novel? And she said, well, just think of it this way. 20 chapters, 10 pages each, or something like that. And I thought, oh, yeah, well, how do you like that? So I kind of thought about that for a while, and that's how I eventually ended up framing it.
Interesting. Yeah, I love that. I thought it was so fun. You are still listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KCI FM, and I am still with Meryl Marco, author of Walking in Circles Before Lying Down, published by Villard, and It's My Effing Birthday, also published by Villard.
And I got a third one, too, called Psycho X Game that I wrote with Andy Preboy that is two voices, and it's a story of a psychotic, crazy relationship.
Oh, so that was a collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Every other chapter by each of us.
Interesting. I'm going to have to check that one out. And your website, is it MerylMarco.com?
It is, oddly enough, MerylMarco.com.
Okay. So Walking in Circles Before Lying Down, when you mentioned Moon Zappa and her novel writing advice, I remembered that in this book, your character is writing, and you have writing a novel, and you have bits of advice throughout the book, and, you know, that the character has to go through 20, you know, crises or something. I don't know. You have all this advice.
Well, I went online and I actually started reading novel. I just typed in how to write a novel online and you get a good 42 million options. And then I just became amused by them and thought, like, wow, I wonder if any of these are worth using. And then I started just applying them to the book as I was writing them.
Well, I found some of them really interesting. I'm sitting there.
There's a lot of crazy stuff online, as I guess everybody must know by now.
But it was, you know, I was thinking about that in terms of, you know, what I heard a long, long time ago, an editor said, we editors like to learn things when we read books. When we read novels, we like to learn things. And I thought, well, and It's My Effing Birthday, there's, you know, little asides about quantum physics and string theory at the end of chapters. And then in this one, there's some novel writing advice.
And the next one's got all kinds of sociobiology. I like to learn things, too, when I read. Maybe your editor was my editor. I actually do. I like Michael Crichton's novels for that reason. They have a good detective story in them, but suddenly you learn about chaos theory. That guy is very, although I didn't care much for his global warming philosophies in his recent book, the rest of them are, he's a very smart man.
So is that something, you know, with both of these books, and when you are writing, that you are consciously trying to put together? Well, I guess so, if you're a plotter, if you're...
You know, I do
plotter,
like that. I really do. I like learning stuff, and I also, when you keep writing novels, you kind of don't want to just hear your own stuff over and over again. You feel, I mean, if I could, almost the ideal way to write a novel would be if you could just download some new software into your brain. You know, like, let's just start over again with a brand new set of observations about everything, because nobody wants to hear me say that same bunch of stuff again.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, there you are writing fiction. You know, I mean, historical fiction opens up a new window to people, and since I'm not writing historical fiction, I've tried to learn something. I try to write about stuff I don't exactly know everything about and learn about it so I can add something.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I just really love these books so much.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad.
I think one thing I love about them, too, is that they're laugh-out-loud funny. I'm sitting on, well, various places in my house. I won't tell you where. And I'm laughing, and my son and my husband are both saying, what are you laughing about? I said, you'd have to read the whole book. I can't just read you a paragraph. I'm not going to do it. And so they're sitting there feeling left out, and I'm thinking, you know, this is not only funny, but there's so many bittersweet things going on throughout the book so that they're funny and they're tragic. It's sort of like these novels that are tragicomic, and instead of just pure humor, you know, just pure, you know, rollicking humor the whole time. And I love that about your writing, I have
to say.
Well, thank
you. That's very kind of you. You know, if I could just make you sob, that will be make me a happy woman.
Well, I may have gotten really sad here. No. I think I did in Walking in Circles Before Lying Down because there's so much going on. But yeah, I mean, you just, you know, when you're such a, so masterful in writing humor and having it work so that there's depth going on as well with the characters and with the story. There was something else I was going to ask in relation to that, and of course, no, I don't remember. What do you read? What do you like to read while you're working on your writing?
Well, actually, I'm writing another book right now, and it's a really a rough go for me, but they all are. You know, I remember myself writing Walking in Circles. It was really rugged writing. I was glad people said it read quickly and sort of effortlessly because it really did not write quickly and effortlessly. It took a lot of effort. And the one I'm writing now, same thing. But I've just been inputting data for it. You know, I feel like I want to know a lot of more stuff. So I've been reading all these books on sociobiology and primates and genetics, and that's what I've been reading. I have a stack of books on mating rituals of insects and when primates of the world. I have that in front of me right now. And I read a book on the history of love through the centuries. I'm just trying to bring something new to it. So yeah. I don't really read very much fiction when I'm writing, because also the other thing is I get paranoid, where I think, oh, my God, this person's so good. I can never be this good, and then I can't bring myself to write. So
it's heartening to hear you say that you go through that, because I think so many writers go through that at all levels. And new writers often think that, you know, well-published or experienced writers, certainly Emmy Award-winning writers like you, would never go through something like that.
Oh, man, I go through it. I really do go through it. In fact, I often say to people, there's an awful lot of people who could write, but the real difference between writers and everyone else is that writers somehow are masochistic enough to sit there and finish stuff. Because it really isn't an easy thing at all. I mean, it isn't. It's the other side of the brain from the play side. It's not got... I started out in art, and art and music are on the side that involves play and even filmmaking. Like when I make little films and stuff, and when I do that, I start in the morning and I look up and it's like 11 at night and I don't know where the day went. When I write, I know where the day went. I am sitting there. It's homework. It's really a different process. It's really the math side of the brain.
Yeah.
So if you, in fact, want to write and you're finding that it isn't a joyous, transcendent experience all the time, welcome to the club.
Mm-hmm.
Most people I know who write feel that way. Rewriting I like better. I mean, when I've got a draft, I don't mind playing with fixing it. I like going through thesauruses and looking for a better word, and I like making it read really fast. But writing the draft is really arduous work.
Yeah. Do you have a regular schedule?
I don't. You know what happens? And the computer has made it worse. Because I work at home, I sit down way early in the morning and I think, like, I read that, oh, man, I can't think of the guy's name suddenly. It'll come to me in the middle of the sentence, maybe. But somebody really famous wrote 1,500 words a day. That's all he asked. No, excuse me, 350 words a day. And I thought, my God, a page? That's all he had to do is write a page? God, how could he get away with so little? But I thought I set 5 pages a day for myself as the least I would write. And then I said, it's a question of when I start, because I start looking at blogs and I start thinking I have to check headlines. I start emailing people and I have to get up and make a snack, and then I have to take the dogs for a walk. And then, I mean, I sort of have to back myself into a start.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't start.
Yeah. Well, it's been...
I always finish everything, though. So
well,
I do.
You do.
I am focused. A lot of times I feel like I'm in a wrestling match with myself.
Well, it's been just great fun talking to you again, and I can't wait till you finish this next book and get this next book out there, because I
can't wait till I finish it.
I know a lot of people.
If you'd like to come and do a few pages, you know, I'd like you to know you're welcome. And all of your listeners also.
Thank you so much.
Everyone could do a couple pages for me, and then I'll fix it later.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's, you know, yeah, having the draft that you can mess with.
Yeah.
It's kind of a relief in a way.
Well, it is a very big relief.
Thanks again, and we'll look forward to the next book.
All right, well, thank you.
I received some emails from listeners who said, tell her I want her to hurry and get the next one out there. So,
and have fun at the Orange County Fair. Be sure to strap in if you go on one of those ones that makes you puke.
Oh, I won't go on them, but thanks.
Oh.
So nice talking to you. Thanks, Meryl.
Okay, bye-bye.